This is Kimbrough Bashir, April 7th, 1995. Dreams in the Analytical Process, Tape 1 of 1.
For our second lecture in the Dream Series. Our next lecture, I kind of want to go over the program just to, because of the locations. Our next lecture and final lecture in the Dream Series is Randy Morris's on April 21st. And he will be speaking on world dreams. And Randy's with us tonight. You want to? Yeah, great. And then we will begin our two lectures on the Nature series, one on May 19th, Tom Jay's, and he will be speaking on language and nature and the mythic edge of reinhabitation. And then coming all the way from Australia is Peter Bishop, who will be speaking on June 2nd on the vegetable world and depth psychology. We'll conclude our year on June 4th with a membership meeting and election of officers for next year at St. Stephen's. And then we have a special event this year on May 15th that I hope all of you will come to. It's a benefit for the library. And that will be at the Alvord's house. And many of you may have attended the New Year's event there, the 12th night. They have a lovely home and a lovely collection of art. And it's a perfect setting for Liz Hunter and Bridget Boardman to lecture on The Hound of Heaven. That's Thompson's poem, The Hound of Heaven, in conjunction with Ives Gamel's depiction of that poem. So it's a kind of special event, and it's particularly to raise funds for the library. I think those are all the special announcements. We are in the process of selecting people for next year to interested in volunteering. So if you're interested in volunteering in any capacity, please either contact me, and you can leave a message for me on the telephone number of the Jung Society, or you can talk to Bunny, who's here this evening. Our guest this evening is Kimbrough Bashir, and he is speaking on dreams and the analytic process. Kimbrough is an analyst here in Seattle and has been here for quite some time. He is a graduate of the C.G. Jung Institute of Zurich and the Episcopal Divinity School of Cambridge, Massachusetts. His practice is on Mercer Island, and he is a member of the Jungian Analysts North Pacific, and he also serves on that board. Kimbrough gave his also has been active and helped us out on the Jung Society and gave us a lecture earlier this year, and tonight he'll add to that with his special knowledge about dreams. So please welcome Kimbrough Bashir.
Thank you, Lucretia. I take it you can all hear me. Well, tonight I'd like to talk about analysis and dreams. I'm going to put analysis first because I found as I got ready for this tonight that analysis is really a lot of what I'm going to talk about, because I think the dream in analysis has a special place and a special chemistry of its own. And the imagery that I'll use tonight has to do with the spiral and the circle and the road. And I hope that you can... I see many of you are in the middle here, but I have a picture here, a photograph. I'd also like to pass around a copy, so maybe you could take a closer look at it, if you could just pass that around. And this is an image of a country road in France. It is entitled En Brie. And I assume that this is the namesake of the famous cheese, brie, of course. But before your stomach begins to do its visceral thing, please note the image. It is of a road in a very flat place. It's a prairie, really, and it has a dreamlike quality to it. For me, growing up in Missouri and spending time in Kansas, I can appreciate what a prairie is, as perhaps the early French explorers must have when they encountered the wild place in the Midwestern part of the United States that looked like one part of their own native land. In a place like a prairie, trees may be the only thing that sticks up. Trees and clouds can be very important images. The cloud by day and the pillar by night was what helped Moses and the Hebrew people journey around and around the Sinai Desert on their 40-year journey to the Promised Land. It wasn't that lofty. It was pretty damn hard. And trees are what line this slowly curving road. Beautifully, symmetrically organized trees that make the road an oasis in the summer shade. But the sky looks somewhat overcast in a very northern European way. It is apparent that the twin line of trees that cover the road have a beginning and an end. But one can imagine that in the middle of the canopy, that the trees may seem endless somewhere in the middle of the road, further down the way, and perspective could be lost. It's a one-lane road, enough for two people to walk comfortably abreast. What is not so clear in the photo is the jog in the road. The road jogs off to the right before it gently curves back to the left toward what is almost invisible in the left corner of the picture, a village. Perhaps it's the village of Brie, a small representation of the collective. In my imagination, on this photo, I carry the road even farther, in an arc that circles in on itself to a center somewhere. Eventually, of course, for what the photo shows us is only a piece of a large road that has come from somewhere and is waiting to go somewhere else. But if we back up to the beginning of the road, the photographer, who happens to be the famous Cartier-Bresson, is standing with his lens, with his eyes, in the middle of an unmarked crossroads. One can see little pieces of this road off to the front right and to the left, off to the right in the lower part of the picture, of this road that intersects where the photographer's standing. And prairie crossroads are famous for giving opportunities for new directions, the unmarked ones, as well as the occasional disastrous car crash. The image seems to ask, should I take this road? And if we look even closer and we right-brain the photo, we can see that the canopy of trees form a heart, something that someone else had to point out to me after I had this photo for quite a while. But is this inviting or is it repulsive? At this crossroads, if it were ancient Greece, there might be a pile of stone somewhere where travelers have made their tribute to Hermes, the god of travelers, who carries messages from the gods on Olympus to the earth and to the underworld, around and around and through and up and down. And for Jung, Hermes is the personification of the psyche, which is constantly changing, and whose trends are not always immediately discernible, if at all. A pile of stones, a sacrifice to a god. If this crossroads is in a devoutly Catholic area, there may be a shrine in memory of someone who has died, maybe in a car crash at the crossroads. A cross at the crossroads, better yet, a crucifix, the sacrifice of a god. And for me, this photo is one image one image, one perspective of what analysis is. But what is analysis? In an era of many flavors of therapy, especially here on the West Coast, and roadside therapy ads that shout depression, family of origin, eating disorders, self-image, done with the help of insurance companies in 10 hours or less, and of pharmaceutical psychotherapy. And these roadside detractions also have their place, for better and for worse. This image is not a fancy one. It is very plain. And one can imagine that to walk on this road could create blisters before there are calluses. It could get too cold or too hot. To me, it looks like early spring. And once you're down there where the road jogs, it could be a long way back or a long way ahead. The Jungian approach to analysis is different in many ways from the traditional Freudian. I use that only by way of comparison because in many ways today I think we're closer in the broad spectrum of things than we are different. And there are many, many derivatives of depth psychology. The spectrum is very colorful. But let us look for just a moment at some of the contrasts between the Freudian and the Jungian point of view. And this is in a very general sense. Rather than consult five times a week, Jung liked to see his analysands, and that word, analysand, is a word I believe he coined, which underlined the analytical alliance in a way that doctor-patient doesn't seem to. Anyway, Jung liked to see his analysands twice a week. And rather than use a couch with an analyst seated behind, fully or partially out of view, Jung preferred two chairs juxtaposed to one another diagonally. Not directly facing each other, but kind of sort of looking at each other. And rather than free association of symbolic material from dreams as raw material for the analyst to make a hotline back to the trauma of childhood, Jung used the method of amplification, a circling, a wandering around the symbol, which may have regressive characteristics, it may take one back to childhood, but may also very well prospectively look deeply inside to what is coming and what is there. Amplification is the job of both the analyst and the analysand. As they circle together to find what clicks as an association. Sometimes the analyst needs his own fantasy to aid what is yet impossible on the behalf of the analysand, but the overall atmosphere at its best favors the analysand's agreement with the interpretation. And rather than a subconscious, in Freud's point of view, that is a garbage pit for the ego's repressed experience, Jung theorized the personal and collective unconscious, which have room not only for ego trash, but for garbage of its own. The fertilizer with the right amount of rain and sunshine and luck may make beautiful flowers and trees and grain that grow by the side of the road. But the ego is not quite as mighty in the face of the unconscious, and the journey requires a developing, healthy, mutual respect between the unconscious and the ego. The unconscious may be dumped into, but it also dumps back, not only with shit, but also with flowers. And there is something more. These mighty trees in this photo suggests that the two who walk their egos down the road together are part of a much bigger environment with roots that plunge deeply into the earth and limbs that bump into each other up above while they are on the road. Birds can build their nests. There may eventually be fruit on the trees or nuts. But there are also times when the trees become a dark forest, making what seems to be a maze with no beginning and no end. An analysis, at least the Jungian kind we are referring to, often but not always begins with two people meeting at the crossroads. One comes to this place because he or she has no idea where to go from there. The other is the invited one, who has been on a road, who has taken some steps, been accompanied many hours on the road as well. Hopefully lots of time on the road, with lots of unexpected holes and dark forests, lots of commitment and money and reflection and ending and starting all over again. A middle-aged woman who had several years of analysis that were quite potent in providing her with perspective on her own process and changing her life, had the following dream. I heard a voice say, "What is the difference between a master and a beginner?" Then, somehow I was handed a circle to ponder. And it came to me that the master knows he has always to begin again, whereas the beginner doesn't yet understand this. The voice of the unconscious. As the analyst is invited by the analysand to be the accompanist on this road in the hour of krisis, which is a Greek word that doesn't necessarily mean the same thing as crisis. It's a Greek word that means the time of decision. At this time, the analyst may know, as Jung did, that the analysand is not the only one going on a journey, nor the only one who will be changed by it. Jung once called the analytical consulting room a place where the most intimate of material is discussed in the most impersonal of settings. The two strangers who meet at the crossroads have a unique relationship, and they will know each other well. They may very well always, however, in a certain way, be strangers, and not really friends. One may ask, as John Lennon once did, but why don't we do it in the road? No, and not lovers either. Somewhere there's always a sacrifice to a God, and a God sacrificed. Yes, there is a banner of the heart in the branches overhead, a shelter. And we can assume that this is true under the ground as well, that there are roots that form the same kind of image. This is a symbol of the relationship between the analyst and the analysand. And because it is invitation to an exploration of the depth of one human psyche, and also an invitation to the depths of the human psyche with a capital P, there will be deep connections. There may be dreams about the other. There may be times of entanglement, of deep joy, and of fear. There are exceptions, of course, one being those who can only find themselves willing to sidle back and forth along the borderline of the road and not get in the center of it. It may be many trees have passed down the road before the analysand can even get in the road, if at all. C.G. Jung found transference to be both a bother and an unavoidable aspect of analysis. Some post-Jungians would say he knew well the power of the transference, for he, rather than Freud, was the first to recommend an extensive training analysis for those preparing to be analysts in order to have a thoroughgoing experience of this themselves. But he also found over-demanding neurotic transferences irritating, and it doesn't seem that he wanted to bother with searching their infantile origins. But again, he knew and spoke of the depth of connection that can be possible and a necessary part of the understanding of the transferential process, which is the road back to the parental imagos and the road forward to recycling and reintegrating those images. Perhaps as divine parents of the earth or the sky, of feminine, of masculine in some way, who hold court on the road of the self. Jung gave dreams about the analysis a special name, transference dreams. An example in the earliest stages of an analysis is of an analyst's dream of a dark-haired young woman seductively luring him forward, only to have a three-year-old with the same dark hair crawl in between them and stop things immediately. This is a dream about what needed serious attention, the infantile needs of the analysand and not the apparent needs of the adult. And on the other side, the said analysand had a dream within the same period of time where both were at a party talking, and the analysand was joking and sarcastic with the analyst, who misunderstood her and got angry. She began to explain to him that this is the way she is in the outer world. And this dream was followed immediately by another dream, that she was in a classroom like her third grade classroom in a parochial school and was worried she'd be late for analysis and got caught up in the class and realized she was 20 minutes late for analysis. But when she arrived for analysis, she apologized profusely, and her analyst, somewhat to her surprise, expressed a great deal of patience, and she was relieved. While these two dreams of the same night showed both of her concerns about this unknown man, the analyst, it would also seem to say that the transference was engaged, and she'd found a place where she risked being misunderstood, and also a place where her history could be dealt with patience, perhaps in a different way than what she experienced with the nuns in her rural parochial school. As an aside at the side of the road, there are two other kinds of dreams that Jung mentions, and these are the subjective and the objective dreams. The subjective dream is of material that points to images or figures that are unknown, but of course, a part of the dream ego's drama. These are inner figures. The objective dream is different in that it is of known people, of places or things such as mother, father, parental home, Uncle Bob, boss, etc. An objective dream seems to deal with the everyday, but usually in an unusually compensatory way. Compensation, of course, was Jung's idea about what dreams were about. And God is in the details of these objective dreams as they compare with the details of outer life. And what I mean by that is that often I find very extroverted people have dreams about all the people in their world. But what happens is the psyche cooks it in a different way. And those little details about things make a difference because it creates another story, another way to look at what's going on in the psyche in relationship to the world. But I think also that there is another category that Jung did not add. I can't go into it in detail, but that is the post-traumatic stress dream, the kind of dream that Vietnam veterans have, or people who have relived terribly traumatic experiences. In other words, the experience is relived as is. And that, of course, requires another kind of therapy, another kind of outlook. Probably outside the scope of normal analysis. Whatever normal is. But objective dreams about objective images, real people in the outer world, real objects, your car, your house, your mother, can also have a subjective character. The third grade classroom in the dream that I've mentioned may have an objective character, but it has a subjective character as well. The classroom today is not a part of everyday experience. She hasn't been there for 20 years, but it has been recycled. And then we must ask, not why, but what purpose does this image serve at this point in her life? It would point to a complex, if you will. I talked about complexes last time I was here. But it would point to something that has emotional content somewhere within it, a range of emotions, a structure of emotional things that are tied together with memory, experience. Something constellates them, usually. What is the complex, again, that it points to? What kind of atmosphere does it engender within her? How does being with the nun, her teacher, compare to coming to her analyst? And subjective dreams of unknown inner figures can not only point to archetypal aspects of the psyche, unknown potential, and innate structures, gods and goddesses, anima and animus, but they can refer to the complexities of everyday outer life, the scary boss, the decision about divorce, the death of the loved one, the grown child that a mother can't let go of. Inner and outer are always at play. Regression and progression, puer and senex. But at the same time, I think there's also a general curve to this road and a destination of some kind that may sometimes only be seen in retrospect. And another example of a dream in the early stages of analysis. The same woman, in her 30s, a businesswoman living in Europe, has spent her entire adult life running away from the environment where she grew up, on a farm in the Midwest. Again, back to the prairie. This is a dream from the third week of analysis. I see a huge white mansion out of the corner of my eye. The same one I used to see as a child as we would round the corner and go up a hill on the way to the doctor's office. I'm at the mansion with some unknown man and we're trying to get out of this maze-like house. We're not inside, but outside on all these spiral ramps. The house is now an apartment building or motel, so access to the rooms are from the outside. The ramps are there so that the maids can bring their carts to the rooms. And I keep thinking how beautiful this mansion is and how it is run down with ramps instead of stairs like it once had. Now this man and I finally find ourselves at the bottom of the mansion through trial and error. Then we find ourselves confronted with another obstacle, a huge pile of wood splinters. I tell the man I'll run to the top of the nearest hill to see if we can get down the other side. It appears to be impossible. So I run to the bottom of the mansion and tell him we'll need to find another way. All the time, we are both hurrying as if time is of the essence. I don't know if we're being pursued or why we're hurrying, but we are. Then he leads me across a hill and down the other side, and I realize we are on the hill by my parents' house, and I can see out of the corner of my eye their white house. There's a feeling that we finally made it. We don't have to hurry anymore. A short interpretation of this dream might be, in the short context of the process at that point, is that this dream, which has been preceded in childhood by dreams of narrowly escaping the pursuit of wild animals by running into the back porch of the parents' home, and dreams as an adult of being chased or seduced by men, including her father, and that this dream is about her own inner structure or self, the White Mansion, the childhood fantasy of her own place someday, perhaps, and it's getting run down. Perhaps all her running has run it down. In real life, she's a harried businesswoman who's tired of spending so much time in motels and apartments and wants to settle down with her husband. The spiraling staircases on the outside suggest perhaps her own search for orientation as to how her outer life should be, circling around and around. But there's also a hint of the self's compensation. I should say that when the self appears in a dream, a self-like structure, it's at a time when the outer situation usually is one of chaos and crisis or crisis. And isn't this going around and around and around, the leitmotif of the whole dream? Going around and up and down and around to her past again? With some unknown man who would appear to approximate her own age? Now, the parental home has an objective reality. Yet the dream appears to show that what has been away from for so long, no longer has to be escaped. But no longer has to be run away from. Perhaps this unknown man is a new animus figure. Previous to this dream, she dreamt of a mulatto man who seemed to combine shadow and animus qualities for her, and also some personal history. This unknown man seems to be a companion, sometimes a guide, running with and slowing down with her on the road to her parental home, as she worries about how to deal with her childhood, as she confronts being a parent herself, with the possibility, should I say, of being a parent. Perhaps this figure is also the analyst, interjected, brought inside. Perhaps you have some other ideas about this dream. We might talk about it later. But I'd like to elaborate on the symbol of the spiral, for I think this is an apt metaphor for the road of individuation. With a quote from Jung in the article Introduction to the Religious and Psychological Problems of Alchemy from around 1935. For those of you who are interested in the reference, this is Collected Works 12, paragraph 34. Jung says, "The way to the goal seems chaotic and interminable at first. And gradually, and only gradually, do the signs increase that it is leading anywhere. The way is not straight, but appears to go around in circles. More accurate knowledge has proved it to be to go in spirals. The dream motifs always return after certain intervals to definite forms, whose characteristic is to define a center. And as a matter of fact, the whole process revolves about a central point or some arrangement round a center, which may, in certain circumstances, appear even in initial dreams. As manifestations of unconscious processes, the dreams rotate or circumambulate around the center, drawing closer to it as the amplification increases in distinctiveness and scope. Owing to the diversity of the symbolical material, it is difficult at first to perceive any kind of order at all. Nor should it be taken for granted that dream sequences are subject to any governing principle. But as I say, the process of development proves, on closer inspection, to be cyclic or spiral. We might draw a parallel between such spiral courses and the process of growth in plants. In fact, the plant motif, tree, flower, etc., frequently recurs in these dreams and fantasies and is also spontaneously drawn or painted. In alchemy, the tree is the symbol of Hermetic philosophy. It's the end of quote. Perhaps the spiral ramps and the pile of splintered wood are related in the dream. Perhaps her own vegetative life has been disintegrated at this point in life, and the Analysand must now walk toward what has been abhorrent to consciousness, namely her parents' home. Jung talked of the integration of the shadow as part of the work of individuation. But another analyst in Zurich used to disagree with him. For the shadow cannot be truly integrated. For, as Jung has said above, it seems to rear its head again and again. Dr. Baker would say that the shadow is not integrated, but recycled. Recycling has little to do with brief therapy. It's often a long, slow process, and that will inevitably be recycled again as well. What I love about analysis, about the work itself, is the presence of the third. We could call it psyche. The roots and the branches, the complexes, and the archetypes that root them. This third factor allows for a process to develop, which for those who find they must invite it offers something richer than the naked waking ego. Analysis can be a boot camp or an initiation pit, but it is also a garden for trees and plants. Trees grow at an unnoticeable pace. But if we cut them down and look at their cross-section, we can see rings around a center, a source. Or as Jung describes the center in reference to the alchemical symbolism, this is also called the uterus. And sometimes along the road, babies are born, a new version of the self. I notice this happens quite a bit at Christmas time, by the way. Women who have had children sometimes can be quite prolific at producing this experience again in their dreams for the psyche's own ends. In the case of the dreamer I've mentioned before, her task was somewhat different. Hers was to find a nest and accept the fact that a nest is a spiraling down place where one can incubate and draw into oneself. In order to further along the spiral, at the crossroads, we must also be able to backtrack and have a decent regression in order to clear the road ahead. When analysis has truly begun, the psyche responds, and the dreams that follow can be seen as having a home within the consulting room. This is why Jung, referring to the alchemists, said that the lid to the analytical container must be kept on tight. Yes, we may pass others on the road, but the dreams shared on the road together need to be watched within the analytical relationship, or they may otherwise be diluted. Lost my place here. Excuse me just a minute. And where does the journey of analysis end? This is often a question asked in the middle of it, or even at the beginning. And I wonder in response, shouldn't it also be asked, how long does it take to get a good education? How long does it take for a tree to grow? I can't answer that except to say that there's one important factor and individuation that should be mentioned. When a good enough relationship between analysts and analysand is reached, when dreams are circumambulated and the analysand hopefully begins to be able to circumambulate independently, the psyche may take a stand for bringing the products, the dreams, the transformations of the trip back to the collective. In other words, to bring fertilizer for the life of the world. The opposite of this is called individualism by Jung. And if you look quite closely at this photo, en brie, the road fades off to the left, and the tree line stops for a while. But soon afterwards, there's the outskirts of a town. What has been private, even lonely work, the opus, doesn't often lead into a little isolated antisocial hermitage. And this is what Jung called individualism, but rather to an expression of individuality that can serve the collective in its uniqueness. And here I end this part of what I have to say with a prayer of the Lakota Sioux, said by those who seek initiation. A sacrifice is made to a god, and a god is sacrificed. And this prayer is, "Great Mysterious, grant me a vision for my life, so that my people may live." And now I'd like to show you some slides. Get some juice. That is a stone. And that is rock. You can see a little bit, some leaves there that give a sense of perspective on this image. But this is the work of water on stone. And you can see, I think, the work. Whoop, that's upside down.
Can you go ahead to the next one? I'll fix it.
Okay. Two of them. The second, yeah, back. Okay. That's a medieval drawing of what's called the Day of Pentecost in the Christian tradition. After the ascension of Christ, and after several days of prayer, this is the result, the coming of the Holy Spirit. And this is pictured as people partaking of the round, of the center. The apostles and Mary, includes the feminine too. She was there. Okay, if we go back. And this is a Maya drawing. Can't see the top of it very well. Can we lower it a little bit, or is it this one? Here's a dance around a pole of some kind. I don't know the details on this image, but I think the image is clear. This pole, of course, would represent the Axis Mundi, the center of the world, which is the center of the spiral. And this is what connects heaven and earth. Actually, I think this is upside down. And this is an image of hell from Dante. Another image of the spiral journey. Another medieval picture. This is a depiction of the place in the Bible where the child Jesus goes into the temple in Jerusalem at the time of the Passover, appropriate for this time of the year. And he speaks with the elders in the temple. He's gone off by himself. He's gotten lost from his parents. And where they, when they find him, he's in the temple confounding the wisdom of the elders. And of course, this is a depiction as of Christ as a symbol of the self. And there's the spiral road that goes up and down. Oh, wrong way. And I'm upside down again. Thank you. And this is a picture from Hindu mythology. This is about the creation of the world. And the good guys and the bad guys churn up the ocean. There's a great conflict between good and evil. But creation is the result of it. Another kind of spiral, if you will. This time with a lot of tension. A squeezy image. And of course, this is an image from a Navajo sand painting. It's really kind of sideways. The top is to the right. But this is amazingly like a picture that Jung talks about in one of the collected works on alchemy. There's an image by a woman that was drawn spontaneously that was very similar to this, with snakes that go around and find not really a circle but a square that is divided into four equal parts. So again, this is an orientation. The spiral orients toward the center. And in this case, it has a fourfold quality to it. Four colors, four directions. Some say five, that the center is the fifth. I guess what helps me to buy the concept of the self is this sense of symmetry in nature. That there are instances where there is symmetry, where there are ways in which there are structures that have an order to them, a crystal. As someone mentioned, I showed some of these slides in Vancouver recently, as someone reminded me, of course, is the double helix. DNA. We're full of spirals. Billions of them. That's water on the right, of course. and a shell on the left. I don't know what kind of shell it is. Does anybody know? This is backwards, but it is an esoteric, someone's esoteric idea of the of a human being. Kind of the subtle body is what it's about, and it shows references to different different glands in the body as centers of energy. This one seems to be centered on the, I don't know what that is. What is it? Pineal? I mean in the center. Well, at the top there's the pineal. The center, it would seem to be the heart. It's kind of an odd shape, isn't it? Of course, there's different ideas about where consciousness is, as Jung said. There, just as an aside, for the ancients, it was in the liver. And it gradually kind of got moved up to the heart, and we think of it probably more in the brain. And as Julian Jaynes points out in his book about the bicameral mind, that even it gets further differentiated into conscious and unconscious mind, two halves of the brain. Well, backwards again. It says expansion on the top and it says contraction on the bottom. Another kind of image of what happens in the mechanics of spirals. And with spiral dreams, sometimes I ask if people are going down. Sometimes people go down into a spiral. I'll show an image of that in the middle one. Often it's counterclockwise is down and clockwise is up, I think. Yeah. Yeah. As someone pointed out, that would be the opposite in the southern hemisphere. I wonder how that affects the way we are. It affects our psyche. Let's see. Does anybody know where that is? Pardon me? No, I don't think it's the Vatican. I believe that's the Guggenheim in New York. Yeah. And this is one of my favorite images of the spiral because if you've been to the Guggenheim, a museum in New York, which was designed by Frank Lloyd Wright, as you go up the spiral, there are rooms off off to the side as you go up. And it's very interesting because you you go into these rooms and there's, of course, beautiful pictures and you come out and you take another lap a little further up. And, of course, as you go up, you look down. You think about where you've been and wonder what's ahead. And as I tried to mention with my photo image, I think that analysis is sort of one piece of that. Maybe one room or two rooms can be in a lifetime. Maybe it's in the middle or maybe it's at the end. Who knows where it is, or at the beginning. Anybody know what that is? A ziggurat, right. It's a ziggurat. A ziggurat comes from the ancient Near East, and it is believed that this is where the idea of the Tower of Babel came from. This is what that story is reacting to. In other words, people building, in a sense, a ladder to God, something like Jacob's ladder in his dream. Trying to get higher, trying to get up there. And in the desert, and I think, sort of my idea is, in the desert, in places where there isn't much vegetation, where there is prairie or dry places, that the sky god becomes very important. You know, our monotheistic religions or even the religion of the Lakota Sioux, for that matter, are very, you know, sky-oriented. And so whatever objects there are in the environment have a lot of meaning. A mountain, a grove of trees, what sticks up out of the ground can be very important. And I like this image also because it has a shadow to it. Sometimes when we're walking up the road, we come to the same place, or we get lost. It's very dark. And we've been there before. And maybe we learn something from it, and maybe we don't. We run into our complexes again and again. And hopefully, if we're paying attention to the journey on that ziggurat, or on that spiral, accompanied or unaccompanied, we get a sense of perspective as we go. We can look back down and say, oh yes, we were down there before, weren't we? And what is it like now? I remember once climbing a mountain in Switzerland with some colleagues from the Jung Institute, and the name of the mountain, interestingly enough, is Grosse Mythen, which means something like the great myths. And it was foggy that day, and we climbed up through the mist and got up to the top, and we had a beer. You know, you can do that. There's, as the Texan said, why do I keep climbing these damn mountains in Switzerland? They all have restaurants on top. And finally, the mist cleared, and we began to walk down, and I wasn't too pleased about looking down because, you know, I was amazed at what we'd come up through. It was kind of scary looking down, to tell you the truth. Of course, I couldn't see it on the way up because it was too cloudy. Yes, those are real people climbing up that, and that still exists.
Where is this?
It's, you know, I think it's either in Iran or Iraq. That's my daughter and me, anyway. Analysts are human beings, yes. We have children, so. Anyway, thank you. So I guess we'll take a break and come back and maybe have comments and questions or like to talk about